Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, a staple of Louisiana kitchens for nearly 40 years. Maker of batters, coatings, boils, tartar sauce, cocktail sauce, and more. Louisiana Fish Fry, because life needs Louisiana flavor. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. It's Jazz Fest time in New Orleans, one of my very favorite times of the year. This week, we're taking you to the festival, where there's always an abundance of music, food, and art. We begin with longtime vendor Greg Arsenault, whose artisan woodworking is a perennial favorite in Jazz Fest's Louisiana marketplace. Greg gives us a crash course in what sets his work apart from the rest. Then, we take you on a mule-drawn ride with the Roman Candyman. On many an afternoon, you'll find Ronnie Kottman on his 109-year-old cart on the streets of Uptown New Orleans. Ronnie and his wagon have also been a regular Jazz Fest vendor since the 1970s. Finally, Steve Armbruster tells us the tale of how the first Food Heritage Stage came to be and the key role his vintage Volkswagen played in those early years. So spread out those blankets and put on some sunscreen. We've got it made in the shade on this week's Louisiana Eats.
I'm Greg Arsenault. I'm a Louisiana cabinet maker building a style of furniture based on Louisiana Creole and Acadian antiques.
Greg Arsenault's roots in southern Louisiana are deeper than a century-old cypress. His Arsenault ancestors settled in the area in the early 1700s. That long history in Louisiana sparked Greg's passion for our state's traditions, the food, the music, the culture, and for Greg, the furniture. Today, you can find his traditional Louisiana pieces in museums, restaurants, and private homes. But I was first introduced to his beautiful work at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. Greg has been a Jazz Fest vendor for decades, and 2024 marks his 35th year at the event. Louisiana Eats joined him at his showroom, Greg Arsenault Cabinet Makers, in Covington. Greg, this interview is a long time coming, and what I'd like to begin with is, how did you receive the calling of furniture maker? Because that's a very rare thing, kind of for the late 20th century, but definitely for the 21st century. So what are you doing here, Greg?
It's pretty archaic. I told my dad when I graduated from high school that I really wanted to become a furniture maker. And he helped me acquire tools, and I started my career basically by teaching myself to use the tools. I worked at jobs doing carpentry work so I could build some skill with saws and measuring. And I went to college at LSU, and I studied fine arts. Sculpture was my major, but I wanted to connect to people's daily lives in a way that had purpose as well as beauty. And I found that furniture was the way to do that. And then I discovered how unique Louisiana style is in not only music, but language and also furniture. Most people don't realize Louisiana has its own style of furniture.
Well, it's more complicated than that, because actually Louisiana has two different historical furniture styles, don't they?
Well, people forget that Spain ruled Louisiana as long as France did. And actually, it's three lines that came together. The American designs were influential. The French lines were very influential, and the Spanish lines were also very much a part of early Louisiana.
I think it's fascinating, Greg, that just as there are marked differences in culinary tastes of Acadian and Creole, that carries through for furniture as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The Creole taste ran to the what was popular in the court of France at the time. So you see the cabriole leg, you see scalloped aprons, you see a little bit more detail, even though the style in Louisiana was much more restrained than you would have seen in continental France. Of course, that was being tempered by the frontier life that the people were living here. When the Acadians arrived, being peasant farmers, they preferred a much simpler style. So you see the tapered leg, clean, straight aprons, definitely much more utilitarian.
Mm-hmm. And was everyone using the same indigenous woods, or were there different woods preferred by the Creoles versus the Acadians?
Well, the Acadians tended to be deal with simpler materials, more domestic materials. Their high-style pieces were built out of cherry, sometimes walnut, mostly cypress, though, which was a very abundant material, easy to work, highly available. The Creoles tended to have richer tastes, and Louisiana has always had a connection with the Caribbean, in particular Cuba. That's where the original mahogany came from. So we've always had access to wood like mahogany or Spanish cedar, and that's our Caribbean connection, but it also is indicative of more of a Creole piece.
Cypress is a particularly forgiving material in this climate, isn't it?
Cypress couldn't have been designed better for this climate. It actually grows in the swamp and the water. It develops resin in it that resists rot and decay, so it couldn't be more designed better to live in this area and be functional in this area.
Greg, I'd like to go back to the time when you were self-taught, when you were training. I'm curious if you have any stories that come to mind that you might want to share with us.
Well, I was very inspired initially by visiting antique stores and antique collectors and seeing their collections and visiting museums. And truly, I found it puzzling because I didn't see necessarily the furniture that was used in Louisiana very much. And I wondered where it came from or where it went. And in talking to some of the collectors, I discovered that because of different traditions in Louisiana, plus the weather conditions here, the fact that we have hurricanes and floods, that those were all contributing factors to what caused there to be so little of the furniture available and passed down through generations. Living in Lafayette for most of the 70s, I heard tales of a grandmother passing away and the family collecting all of her belongings and piling them up and burning them.
Why?
Well, they didn't want the gree-gree. They didn't want that grandmother's ghost coming to visit them. So that was a tradition that was throughout Louisiana, and that's another contributing factor as to why there's so few early Louisiana pieces.
It dawns on me that from your artist and furniture maker's point of view, I'm guessing that if you see an old piece of furniture, it's going to speak volumes to you about the person who built it.
Absolutely. And you can see their attention to detail in how well the joints fit together and how smooth the surface is. Even in an antique, these days we have machine tools that can do a lot of the work for us. But in days gone by, they did everything by hand, and it was a much more laborious process and harder to make those surfaces polished like they ended up being. When I first started, I assumed that I would be an anonymous furniture maker like so many of the people from the past. And I was totally all right with that. But as my career has progressed, I've gained a little bit more notoriety, apparently.
Well, between the incredible museum recreations and just the unbelievable things that you have accomplished over your career, what do you hope your legacy to be?
Well, I hope my legacy is an inspiration to someone to continue the work and to continue building pieces with the integrity that antiques have. Unfortunately, in this day and age, everything's mass-produced out of particle board and veneer, and there's no longevity in that. There's planned obsolescence for those pieces. And that's in hopes of in 5 years you'll throw that out and buy new stuff. I build stuff for you to pass down to your grandchildren and their grandchildren. I have to be very careful as to the style that I pick and the details. I want things to have classic beauty and classic composition, so I pay attention to those details. Unfortunately, a lot of the younger generation doesn't see the value, and I'm going to say yet.
Yet.
Because as they age, they will come to appreciate things a little in a different light.
Things that don't need to be replaced so readily, perhaps. Huh?
Correct. we live in a disposable age, and what's trendy today may not be trendy in a year or 5 years. I've chosen to build classic style furniture that is made to endure generations.
Well, Greg, this has been such a treat to have this opportunity to
sit
and
visit
thrilled. With you.
Thank you, Poppy, for thinking of me. And, a lot of times I feel like a redheaded stepchild because people really don't understand what I do or what I can do for them. And this has been a great opportunity. Thank you very much.
That was Greg Arsenault of Greg Arsenault Cabinet Makers in Covington, Louisiana. He can be found in the Louisiana Marketplace the first weekend of the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival and at gregarsenault.com. Perhaps best of all is to do like we did and personally visit Greg's workshop in Covington on the North Shore in St. Tammany Parish. Coming up next, we climb aboard a century-old cart for a ride with longtime Jazz Fest vendor, the Roman Candyman. Louisiana Eats returns after the break. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Crystal Hot Sauce, always made with just three simple ingredients: aged red cayenne peppers, distilled white vinegar, and salt. Nothing artificial. Crystal Hot Sauce. Step out of the heat and into the flavor. From Rouse's Markets, synonymous with seafood, straight from Louisiana's waterways. Rouse's Markets tastes like home. And from Camellia Brand, beans done right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923. Camellia's latest innovation makes life easy for today's smaller households. Beans for two. If a bag of beans is too big for your family, Camellia's New Orleans-style red beans for two and Cajun-style white beans for two has everything needed for dinner in today's smaller households. Learn more at CamelliaBrand.com. The ship bell rings, accompanying the sound of mule hooves on the streets of uptown New Orleans. The Roman candy man is coming. The mule knows the way up Octavia Street to St. Charles Avenue as Ronnie Cotman pulls the shiny strands of taffy. This sight has been a daily occurrence in New Orleans since 1915, when Ronnie's grandfather, Sam Cortez, began selling taffy candy, a recipe that originated with his grandmother in Sicily. Every bit of the wooden cart is original, from the shiny marble surface that cools the candy to the big iron hook that holds the sticky mass as it's pulled again and again before being cut into lengths and rolled in wax paper. Ronnie, thank you for letting me ride the wagon with you today.
Oh, you're welcome.
So where are we going?
Today we're going to ride around the uptown neighborhood, and I'm going to eventually end up over by Newman School.
Do you have a regular routine?
Not exactly. I just kind of go around the neighborhoods and feel it out and see where I might be able to sell the most candy, and that's where I'm going to work, you know.
So what was your grandfather's routine? He had a regular one, didn't he?
Not a regular routine, but he had, you know, certain routes that he worked, and he covered way more of the city than I do. His western boundary was the causeway, and to the east he went across the Industrial Canal into the Ninth Ward and Chalmette, and he worked from the lake all the way across the river to Algiers and Gretna.
He crossed the river?
Yeah, you used to be able to get on a ferry, and you know, in those days they had ramps that were built for horse and wagon, and they had slats on the ramp, so the horses could catch the slats with their feet, and they wouldn't slip. And so you could get on a ferry and go wherever you needed to go. Ooh. Hi. We got strawberry, vanilla, or chocolate?
Can I get one of each?
$3. Thanks a lot.
So, how did your grandfather become the Roman candy man?
Well, my grandfather, his parents came from Sicily. He was a first generation born here, first generation American. As a little kid, he was run over by a streetcar when he was about 10 years old and lost both legs. Basically, you know, when he went back to school after the legs healed, they considered him to be a problem at school because he had to be carried around, and he drove a little goat cart to get to and from school, and sometimes the kids used to let the goats run around the school, and they didn't seem to like that too much. It was goats running through the classrooms wasn't fun, not for the administration anyway. So they kicked him out. He was booted out of school in the third grade, and so he had to do something. So he took the goat cart, put some fruit and vegetables on it, and he went out peddling from the time he was like 12 years old. He was a peddler. Eventually, you know, he got a full-size wagon instead of a goat cart. But his mama used to make this candy. She just made it for special events, you know, like Christmas and New Year's and St. Joseph Day and things like that. Anyway, sometimes she'd have candy left over, so he'd just take it with him out on the route, and he sold that. And after a while, people started asking for it. Yeah.
Ronnie, I know you've had a bunch of mules over time, and one of them, if I'm correct, her name was Rose, and she was sort of a special mule, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah. Rose was the smartest animal I've ever been around, of any kind.
So she even knew how to parallel park, I think, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, the first time I went downtown with her, you know, we had a spot that was in between two cars, and that was the only place to park down there, so, you know, I pulled up next to the lead car and tilted her in toward that car, which is, you know, not something you normally do. I mean, normally you don't try to get as close to a car as you can. And then I pulled the reins back and backed her up, and we kind of snaked on into the spot. And we get in the spot, and she's just kind of looking in all different directions, looking around and thinking, man, that was cool. So, you know, I showed her, I think, one other time. And after that, you could just pull up to a car and just pull on the reins back, and she would just back it right in there. Hi. We got strawberry, vanilla, or chocolate?
I'll take strawberry.
All righty. Thank you very much.
Ronnie, thank you so much for taking me on this fantastic ride. I have to confess, this has really kind of been a lifelong fantasy for me, a ride on the Roman Candy Wagon.
Well, you're welcome. I know you've been waiting a long time for this.
Ronnie Cotman, Roman Candyman, from his 109-year-old cart on the streets of Uptown New Orleans. You can visit Ronnie and his wagon every day at Jazz Fest, parked inside the fairgrounds near the Gentilly Gate, the same spot he's occupied since the 1970s. Stop by for some candy, and please give my love to the Roman Candyman. Every week after the news bulletin, the anticipation gradually builds until we hear that telltale theme song. Which, of course, was composed and recorded for us by none other than Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. The New Orleans funk rock band has become a regular favorite at Jazz Fest. The boys sat down with us to share some of their Jazz Fest memories and to talk about the meals they enjoy off and on the stage.
Hi, this is Mark Parody, a.k.a. Johnny Sketch. I play cello, guitar, and I sing for Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes.
Hello, my name's Andre Boren, and sometimes they call me Dirty Johnny, and I play drums and sing with Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes.
Your mother will be so proud.
My name is David Pomerleau, and I sing and play the bass in Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes.
My name is Omar Ramirez. I am also known as Johnny Rico, and I play the trumpet in Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes.
Welcome back to Louisiana Eats, boys. I'm always thrilled to see you guys.
Hey, Poppy.
You know, just for the record, we have to give the big shout out to Cousin Dave over there, Pomerleau, who, because of him getting a special idea every week when people listen to Louisiana Eats, what are they listening to, guys?
The theme music from Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes for my lovely cousin, Poppy Tooker.
Do you know what the name of that song is? It's called Let's Eat.
Well, let's eat, but before we eat, let's talk. I really wanted to pick your brains about your Jazz Fest experiences, because you all have been consistently appearing at the festival for over a decade now, and things certainly changed over that period of time. I remember, I think the first time I saw you all at the festival, you were on the Gentilly stage.
That's right. The first year we did play the Jazz Fest, we were on the Acura stage.
The first?
Yeah, that was in 2005. We were supposed to play in 2004, and it was rained out. And I think maybe as a kind of a act of pity, they gave us a really excellent set the next year, which was ended up being our debut performance. So we were on the Acura stage at 3:30 in the afternoon, which is also Dave Matthews was headlining that night on the same stage. I think probably when we played, there was at least 30,000 people in the field, maybe more. It was basically as full as it was going to get because so many people came early to hear Dave Matthews. Now, that's kind of a double-edged sword. Yeah, we got to play for an ocean of people, but most of that ocean of people were just waiting for Dave Matthews.
I bet you got some new fans out of that crowd.
No, we definitely did, and I'll play for an ocean of anybody, no matter what the circumstances. So it was pretty spectacular.
Well, take us along with you on a day at the festival. How does it go? Do you get good parking?
Well,
you either park in the Gentilly lot or the Acura stage lot, and they really have it all organized beautifully, so you're just whisked away.
They shuttle you to wherever you need to be.
Each thing you need to do. And some years we'll do CD signings, and you know, you finish playing and you take a breath and they say, okay, come on, we got to go to the CD signing, and they whisk you away to that. And it's just really well run. And they take care of the artists beautifully, you know?
They do a really smart thing, too, which the first few years I didn't understand, because I said, why can't we have a van and a trailer, why can't we just pull it up behind the stage and load it out? I mean, we were getting out of one van, putting all of our gear into another van. They were driving us back there. And now that I'm a little older, I realize it's probably a smart thing to not have a bunch of musicians driving amongst, you know, 100,000 pedestrians on a dirt track who don't really know where they're going. It seems like a slightly more responsible situation, and it works. And like Dave said, it works really well. They've got it down to clockwork.
So how do they feed you at the festival? What's craft service like?
Well, standard fare backstage food is, you know, you get your ice chest full of sodas and beers, and then you get your deli tray, which is like every backstage in America and elsewhere, I'm sure. Little triangle sandwiches with the crust cut off. And hey, don't get me wrong. I think we're all pretty big fans of those.
I can eat a lot of those.
Those sandwiches are pretty good.
Party sandwiches.
They're great.
Those aren't deli.
Well, whatever you want to call them.
New Orleans, party sandwiches.
Okay, party sandwiches, darling.
But in general, I don't think the bands accept the Jazz Fest gig for the backstage catering.
No. We did have a deal going with tips for a while where we said, hey, Tipitina's. We will grace you with our presence, but we require Popeye's chicken. And they honored that for a while, but I think they've given up on the chicken. We didn't get it the last time.
Oh.
It's probably better. It's not the best pregame food.
Oh, it's the aftergame.
It's an after, yeah.
Right.
By then, everybody's eating it.
Everybody's eating it, and all that's left is the bones.
We have had some fun with Popeye's fried chicken before. Remember the time that you all were throwing fried Popeye's hand pies from the stage at around 2 o'clock in the morning? They were strawberry.
I will never forget that.
Winging those pies from the stage at Tipitina's, that was wild.
It was
People
awesome.
Couldn't believe it.
In this city, we're used to having things thrown to us from the Mardi Gras tradition. But most of that stuff about a week later just kind of looks like garbage, you know? Not garbage per se, but it doesn't serve any purpose. It goes into a bag and you forget about it for 360 days. A Popeye's hand pie has immediate appreciable value, especially at 2 a.m. when you've been drinking at a show. That was like throwing money into the crowd. People's faces lit up. And I think at the Maple Leaf one time we had
a fried chicken flash mob.
And we put a bunch of boxes out on the bar, and then we passed boxes over the crowd like they were crowd surfing through, and everybody took a winger. It was so cool. And there's nothing better than watching a crowd that's dancing and eating chicken at the same time. It's a very New Orleans moment for me. Oh, never fall. Exasperating fools who fail to heed the call. He's the right man. Got a power wrong.
He's calculating victory until the dawn. Goes on. Our friends, the Louisiana Eats House Band, Johnny, Sketch, and the Dirty Notes. Coming up next, we go back to the early days of the Food Heritage Stage with the help of Steve Armbruster and the Jazz Fest Archives. Louisiana Eats returns after the break. I'm I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Blue Plate Mayonnaise, the beloved secret ingredient of Louisiana kitchens for over 90 years, made with just oil, vinegar, and egg yolks. Now Blue Plate is dressing up seafood feasts with a new creamy cocktail sauce. Enhanced with bold horseradish and a secret blend of spices, you just dip, savor, and say, ah. And for a touch of Creole charm, Blue Plate's Creole tartar sauce, complete with pickles, aromatic herbs, and a touch of Creole mustard, all together in that classic mayo base. Blue Plate mayonnaise, it's the good stuff. And from Louisiana Fish Fry, now doing for chicken what they've always done for fish. Fried chicken tenders, wings, sandwiches, and more. Louisiana Fish Fry has you covered with a mix specially for chicken. Louisiana Fish Fry, because life needs Louisiana flavor. And from Visit the North Shore, discover world-class culinary flavors on the North Shore this spring. Experience the bounty of the bayou and rich culture from award-winning chefs, soulful mom-and-pop restaurants, extraordinary bakers, and creative mixologists. To learn more, request the Explore the North Shore Visitor Guide for inspirational stories, custom itineraries, and event information at visitthenorthshore.com. St. Tammany Parish, Louisiana's easy escape, just 40 minutes from New Orleans French Quarter.
Chef Frank Brightson of Brightson's Restaurant.
Thank you. 1998 Jazz Festival. Now, I'm going to do a dish today for you that I think is representative of the type of food that we do at Brightson's and also the flavors and dishes that I love.
Chef Frank Brightson and I agree. Our favorite cooking demo of the year is always on the Food Heritage stage at Jazz Fest. And since it started in 1989, chefs from New Orleans and beyond have wowed visitors with their cooking demonstrations. Here's a small sampling of some of the voices over those 35 years.
I'd like to say, first of all, that I think you people, and I can tell by looking at you, are the smartest, best looking, luckiest people on the whole planet to be here today. Because you're in the best place. Great food, great music, great people. And we're going to have nothing but fun.
Here's Frank Brightson back in 1998. Consummate entertainer that he is, every second of Frank's demos were solid gold.
We're going to cook catfish today. Now, you've had catfish, I know. Everybody eats catfish. But you ain't never had it like this. You know, when I create a dish, I try to build certain components or characteristics into it so that you have an interesting dish. You know, food, unlike many other arts or crafts, is something that touches you. I mean, you get touched so many ways. You know, it's so physical, it's so emotional, it's so mental, and it's so pleasurable. And smell is certainly a part of that. Visual, the presentation of a dish is certainly important. And of course, the eating part of it is the best, too.
Anybody who's just joined us, this is Lucy Mike King. She's a strawberry farmer from Hammond, Louisiana.
I've been growing strawberries since I was 5 years old, and I'm going to be 79.
It's not just chefs who graced the Food Heritage stage at Jazz Fest. One mainstay was strawberry farmer Mrs. Lucy Mike, who always appeared there both weekends. Miss Lucy Mike was one of a kind.
I used to grow about 10 acres. Now I have a half an acre.
Half an acre.
Because I do all the work myself. I do everything except the tractor work. I dig the ditches and everything. One man came with a big station wagon. He had a 12-foot ladder on the station wagon. I said, sir, what are you going to do with that ladder? He says, I am going to get on it, and I am going to pick the biggest and the sweetest strawberry on the tree. I told him, sir, we don't pick strawberries like that. He said, well, how do you pick them? I told him, you put your head to the ground and you fan it to the sun.
Time marches on. The young get old and the old get cold. Time marches on. Nothing lasts forever.
Time marches on. That muffled voice you hear is none other than Austin Leslie, one of the greatest Creole chefs of all time, renowned for his restaurant, Chez Helene.
Now see how easy that was? That's like a piece of cake.
Austin was a New Orleans icon, never seen without his signature captain's hat and bushy mutton chop sideburns. To paraphrase John T. Edge, if you were looking to portray what New Orleans cooking was, there were two chefs, Paul Prudhomme and Austin Leslie.
I love you.
We'll end with this one last clip to give you a taste of Austin Leslie's sense of humor.
I tell you what, I'm going to tell y'all a pretty clean joke, since y'all want to hear some jokes. I know y'all didn't ask for them, though. Now, Worcestershire sauce, you know how they got this name, Worcestershire sauce? Fellow was eating, and he didn't know how to name what he wants, so he said, what is this here sauce? And they gave it a name, Worcestershire sauce. Don't that make sense? Now don't ask me another thing how much I put in here, so watch me now. You see what I'm doing, eh? Everybody see what I'm doing, so there's no secret, there's no voodoo here now, don't tell me.
Thirty-five years of the food heritage stage at Jazz Fest? But how did it come to be? To get the answer to that question, we turn now to our next guest.
I am Francisco Della... No, you want my real name. My name is Steve Armbruster.
Long before he began his career as an attorney at law, Steve Armbruster was a man who wore many hats in his New Orleans life. He co-founded Tipitina's in 1977 and worked at WWOZ Radio. In the 1980s, he had jobs in fine dining kitchens at Upperline, the Roosevelt, and lost local restaurant, Christian's. Midway through the decade, he began regularly feeding Jazz Fest staff, doing the build-out at the fairgrounds. All of these incarnations of Steve Armbruster made him uniquely qualified to bring a new stage to the festival, the Food Heritage Stage, where New Orleans cooks could talk about food and demonstrate it. Steve explains the origins of these food stages and how he got started.
The very first Food and Heritage Stage was exactly 20 years after it started. It was for the 20th festival, which was 1989. 3 or 4 or 5 years before that, I forget exactly how many, I signed on to help Tag Richardson and the crew that would put up the tents, build the stages, to just be a general laborer. I thought it would be fun. I thought it would make a little extra money. I liked the festival. They quickly realized, like after about one day, that I knew how to cook. They remembered that I'd been cooking. So at that time, believe it or not, everybody who would work to build the stages would just leave the grounds to go get lunch. They would, you know, hop in their trucks and they'd go off to get poor boys, a Popeye's fried chicken, and, you know, couple of Barks root beers later and a heavy lunch, they would come dragging back into the fairgrounds and slowly but surely, you know, try to get back on track. And Tag and others realized, you know, that was a pretty inefficient way to, you know, run a crew. And wouldn't it be more fun and wouldn't it be better if I would just cook for everybody? So I started cooking for the production crew, the yard crew. And I did it sort of on a shoestring by, you know, hook and fly. I would maybe set up a barbecue pit out there, or I would cook some things in my house, which was close by. I lived on Grand Route St. John. And I had an old Volkswagen. I would take the back seat out and lay the back flap down. So I might cook a pot of beans, make a salad, have some bread. I would put it in the back of my Volkswagen. I would drive over there, and everybody would see my Volkswagen coming onto the track, and they'd drop their hammers and they'd run over to wherever I happened to park that day, which was under one of the trees or table, and we'd have lunch.
The Volkswagen dinner bell, huh?
Yeah, there you go. By any means necessary, we fed everybody who was there.
And how many people are we talking about in those days?
14, 15 at the beginning, 20, 25, to 50 or 60 or 70 during the week before. It was the perfect job because I didn't have to do anything during the festival itself, because then everybody could get food from the vendors. And also, I knew everybody by then, so, you know, I was, you know, welcome anyway.
Yeah, you were
was,
a big man on
terrific.
Campus.
Yeah, they liked me. I'd been feeding them. And so anyway, so that's one way that I got to know all of the people who were at the fairgrounds and how they got to know me in relation to food. And I did that for a couple of years, and then they decided that they wanted to do this food heritage stage in 1989 for the 20th anniversary. So
they suggest to you, hey, Steve, can you help us out? Because you seem to be able to do everything else you can think of. So what did you do?
Well, the idea was to get the food vendors who are out there to come to the tent and talk about the food that they were serving out there. The producers of the festival did want to educate people about this food, of which they were very justly proud.
Tell us about that first year, because things didn't turn out so well because you schedule somebody, but the line at the booth got too long, huh?
So the first Food and Heritage stage was under a tent, and it was back towards what would be, you know, the Acura stage now by that pond. The tent was just to the left of it. And the idea was to have a lot of the food vendors. A lot of them would send word, you know, I really can't leave my booth. I'm really busy.
Mm-hmm.
The folks that I've hired here, they don't want me to leave. They get nervous if I'm out of sight, or I get nervous when I have to leave them. So I stocked up a variety of, you know, different sorts of food things, you know, like red beans and rice and pickled meat to have on hand. So sometimes I would just improvise a demonstration of, you know, how to make shrimp stuffed melaton or, you know, shrimp stuffed peppers.
So in addition to food vendors, because that was the original thought, how did the first chef sneak into the Food Heritage stage?
I knew chefs because I worked as a chef myself. I knew some chefs, like Susan Spicer, from before either of us ever cooked. The first time I met Susan Spicer, she was working for a printing company on Julia Street between Chartist and St. Charles, and I was working at Tipitina's. It was the year we started Tipitina's, and we would go down there to get posters printed. I pressed her into service, and she was glad to do it, and Frank Brightson. Some of the chefs, though, from, you know, your more so-called prestigious or, you know, establishment restaurants, even at that time thought of the jazz festival as something of a fringe operation or, you know, a countercultural, irrelevant production, or it's something that, you know, just didn't really relate to what they were doing. And they just weren't really interested, or maybe they just didn't want to give their secrets or something
so
like that.
So fascinating to think that they had no idea that one day that little fringe festival would actually account for such a huge percentage of their annual business.
Yeah, and they should have realized it even then, and of course some of them did. So Frank came, and Susan came, and I'm not sure who all else came, but I think I did press a few other folks into service.
Well, with your long, long vision of all this, did you ever think it would become what it is? I mean, it's such an institution.
It really is fun for a lot of reasons. One reason is because everybody loves to eat. And everybody in Louisiana, it seems, is very passionate about their food, and they all think that they have the best recipe for gumbo or griots, or they know how to grill better than anybody else, or they think that their food is almost as good as Frank Brightson's, but that maybe if they go and listen to him, they can do a little industrial spying and pick up some tips. So people, you know, they're curious about food. And they like talking about it, and they like listening to it. And I think that people who come from out of town see these names on the tops of the food booths, Cochon de Lait, and they wonder about it, and they taste some of the food, and they want to learn a little bit more, so, you know, they go. I think, you know, of course, some people just go to the stage because it's air-conditioned, it's inside, and there's free food.
And there's free food. You can't beat that. That's true.
Yeah.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for having this conversation.
You're
with
welcome.
Us. That was Steve Armbruster, Food Heritage Stage Instigator.
Welcome to the city where people like to eat. And the music, 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 you can't resist the beat. There's lots of good ladies like you never seen. But there ain't no city like New Orleans.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Catch up on previous editions of Louisiana Eats on poppytooker.com, where over a decade of Louisiana Eats is available for pod and webcasting, along with recipes and cooking class videos, too. And don't forget to rate us on your preferred podcast platform. We'd like to welcome our new major sponsor, Blue Plate Mayonnaise. When your poor boys, potato salads, and remoulade need that authentic New Orleans flavor, Blue Plate Mayo. That's the good stuff. And big thanks to our returning flagship sponsor, Dickie Brennan and Company. Happy Hour is back, Tuesday through Friday, 4 till 6 p.m. at the Black Duck Bar, upstairs at Dickie Brennan's Palace Cafe on Canal Street. With live music, a new oyster bar featuring crudo and other cold seafood selections, and as always, the largest rum selection in the South. Dickie Brennan's Palace Cafe serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner Tuesday through Sunday weekly with jazz brunch on weekends. Louisiana Eats is also made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Louisiana Fish Fry, Crystal Hot Sauce, Rouse's Markets, Visit the North Shore, and Camellia Beans, celebrating their innovative new product, Beans for Two. Camellia's new red beans for two and white beans for two include everything needed to cook two authentically seasoned bowls of beans, scaled for today's smaller households. Learn more at CamelliaBrand.com. And from D'Agostino Pasta, celebrating our culture with fleur-de-lis, crawfish, and alligator-shaped pastas. All handcrafted in Louisiana, just as it's been done in Sicily for centuries. Visit D'AgostinoPasta.com to learn more. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner, producers Blake Longlinet and Steve Himmelfarb, with writing contributions from Becky Retz and to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Catch up with us anytime on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.